Be back to Davis again. this is a subject that is actually something I've been thinking about for a long time, much longer than you might think. But what I'm going to tell you about is some work that I did with Ronnie that appeared, I guess, 2 months ago now. 2000. Sorry. What is this, October 2008? I'm still recovering from a cold, by the way, so my thought processes are not completely straight. Anyway, please ask questions if something is if something is confusing. Okay, so until recently, this was the status of the ratio of positron flux to positrons plus electrons as observed by a number of different experiments, and it goes back many, many years. This is in the general mold of, you know, looking in the heavens for particle physics here on Earth. You know, it's had its successes over the last century, so it seems like a reasonable place to start.
So all these are outside the atmosphere?
Not necessarily. Now, if you force me on that one. Some of them are balloon experiments that have gone up to well above the atmosphere, to sort of at the level of, you know, maybe 1% or something like that. Yeah, I mean, the heat experiments of this type. So several are balloon experiments. Some are not necessarily that way, and if you force me to distinguish them all, I'm not going to attempt that. So the scatter, obviously, you know.
Basically, the answer is yes, satellite or a balloon.
I don't think there's any. I don't think there's any satellite experiment. What I can speak to...
AMS.
Well, it's not a satellite. It was space shuttle.
But
okay. If you want, call it... Yeah, that's fine. It's right. So that's right. So there are a number of experiments. One AMS, Oh, wow. This is great. Okay. We get into the fray right away.
Sorry.
So, no problem. That's right. So AMS was one experiment that was a detector, which I'll... not so dissimilar from I guess how Pamela is designed. Flew on the space shuttle for about 2 weeks and collected information about positrons and electrons and constructed the ratio, and the points are buried somewhere in here. Heat was also a balloon experiment, and several of these others were balloon experiments. And now, if you force me on the details, I'm going to have to do this. But okay, this is the status that it was. Not that long ago, after the Pamela experiment, which had been running for a couple of years, released their information this past October, they presented this wonderful plot. And this is the thing that's got everyone excited. You've already heard, I guess, from Nima, his own interpretation of this and other anomalies that are there. This talk, the focus is going to be on Pamela, and I'll make comments where necessary and where they come up about some of the other anomalies and experiments that are out there. Okay. What do they find? So they find, so there was already a scatter, and depending on how you clean this data up, there was some indication of some sort of rise in the fraction of positrons. Pamela goes and measures the same thing, and they also see this, you know, wonderful rise. Do I have a pointer just to... anything would be great, I'm sorry, I didn't think of that ahead of time. I'll use my hand in the meantime. So they see this wonderful, interesting rise, and it's the interpretation of that that is something that has gotten many of us excited about the prospects of this for dark matter. So let me give you then the outline. So the outline is to tell you a little bit about the Pamela experiment as far as I understand it, just so everyone's on the same page about what this experiment is, what it measures, and what it doesn't measure. Then I'm going to tell you about annihilating dark matter, aspects both of the particle physics as well as the astrophysics related to this. I'm going to tell you about this.
What's really going to, in principle, move you forward if you just plug that into a USB thing?
I think I'll.
It's also a laser.
Yeah, well, okay, let's.
It may be regarded as a 4-inch keyboard.
I knew transparencies were great. No problem. Here, let's try this again, and let me just run it again. Oh, keyboard is set up assistant. Nope, we don't want that one. Okay.
You just say yes or whatever.
Oh, is that all I have to do?
Yeah. Or cancel or...
Click on that window and then exit.
It's identifying the keyboard.
Fine. Yeah, just say hi.
Hey, how are you doing?
Oh, I see. It's really thinking.
It's really thinking. Yeah. Let's maybe... I don't need this, so let's... Right. We're fine. No problem. I just need to figure out how I...
To bring your mouse over to the other window.
There we go.
Good.
All right, we're all back. Great. So I'll tell you a little bit about annihilating dark matter, particle physics, and the astrophysics associated with this. A piece of code that we use to actually implement some of the astrophysics side of our analysis called Galprop, and I'll tell you a little bit about that. Give you the results, and then an interpretation of Dirac dark matter in a very specific model. Okay. So off we go. So the experiment. This is a sort of a schematic of the experiment to give you an idea of what it is. It is a detector designed to look for protons, antiprotons, positrons, positrons, electrons, light nuclei. Yeah. Okay, so basically the fairly simple and the largest flux cosmic rays that are in the galaxy. It has done this by taking this apparatus, which is roughly a meter and a half tall, attached it to a Russian satellite. The satellite itself, I think, is designed to look down on Earth, and this thing is sort of attached to it looking up into space. Okay? So this is you can sort of think of this as looking up into space in this direction. It consists of a number of components to it. One, a tracking device that has a magnetic field associated with it, the magnetic field about 0.4 Tesla, so it has the ability to bend charged tracks in one or another direction, thereby trying to separate charged, different plus from minus charged particles. Yeah. And then it has a calorimeter of some number of plates, and at one point in my life I knew what all of this was. Someone else will, off the top of my head. Silicon tungsten or something, but anyway, all right, anyway. A calorimeter that is designed to just measure the energy of particles that go into it. This calorimeter you should think of is very much analogous to the electromagnetic calorimeter of, say, the ATLAS experiment or other similar experiments. So it's designed to stop particles like photons and electrons and positrons, but things like protons or nuclei, if they're energetic, you know, they'll just pass right through, okay? So think like an electromagnetic calorimeter. And then there's a few other components that are designed to, well, this thing, what they call a neutron detector, but it's another piece to try to take off that.
There's a magnet?
Sorry, what?
It has a magnet?
Yeah. It has a magnet, yes. It has a magnet. It's not shown here, but it's the magnetic field sort of points into the screen. It's about 0.4
permanent
Tesla.
Magnet.
Permanent magnet, yeah, 0.4 Tesla, yeah. So what it's supposed to be able to do is the following: to measure the spectrum of protons and antiprotons and electrons and anti-electrons, positrons, and other light nuclei, which I've sort of cut off here for the purposes of this talk to focus this, in various energy ranges. And you can see it goes at least for say, electrons and positrons up to hundreds of GeV, antiprotons 200 GeV, protons up to 700. This is something that has been measured to well past that, as we'll see. And in fact, there has now been preliminary information from Pamela on the proton spectrum, on the antiproton spectrum, as well as this ratio with respect to the positrons and electrons. So if you go back to this plot that I had here, this one, there we go. You notice the axis on this went up up to tens of GeV or so. And at that point, that tens of GeV, you know, the error bars are huge, okay? So the knowledge of the the knowledge of the positron flux ratio was very poor once you got above this point. Okay. So it has the potential to go, you know, much higher in energy.
So, Graham, is this supposed to be clear why these ranges are different for the matter versus antimatter?
Some of it has to do with the overall flux, just the number of particles that you've got impacting, and then, you know, collecting data from that.
Would you get a significant?
Okay, so for example, the most numerous particles that are coming in are at high energies. The energies we're thinking about, you know, tens or hundreds of GeV, are protons, and then next to that are electrons, and then next to that are some combination of positrons and antiprotons. I can even give you some numbers for fluxes at some point.
But an antiproton of 500 GeV would be well measured, or? No, it's outside the range, so.
Right, so no. So some of this, okay, again, now, if you press me on details, some of this will have to do with whether they have the charge sign separation, okay, at high energies. Some of it will have to do with just, as I said, the overall flux that it will have and the number of events, okay, and other characteristics of the detector.
Some of that is due to the charge separation, and you can see because electrons add positrons, they don't need to tell the difference, right? They go up to 2 keV, right? So a lot of it is literally just limited by that.
Right, exactly. Okay, what does it look like? Here is an event. I stole this from a talk that was given at the Slack Summer Institute, a 36 GeV interacting proton. What does this mean? Much of the time, protons will fly all the way through the detector, leaving little or no trace in the electromagnetic calorimeter, okay? But occasionally they do. And when they do, they leave sort of this sort of pattern of stuff, yeah, in the electromagnetic calorimeter. This is what a proton looks like. This is what an electron looks like. This is what a proton looks like. This is what an electron looks like. And I keep on doing this back and forth.
You're training our neural network.
I'm training your neural network, as they would say. Okay, and the idea is that, among other things, the shower profile within within the electromagnetic calorimeter is qualitatively different, and that is one of the pieces of information that's used to separate, then, for example, a positron from a proton. Since the flux of protons is the highest flux that is coming in from the galaxy. At a level of what? It's at a level of, depends on what energy you're talking about, but it's neighborhood of 10 to the 3, 10 to the 4 times more protons than positrons. You need a very good rejection rate of the ability to separate a proton from a positron to be able to actually carry out this experiment.
Okay.
Very much like that, yeah, right. There are various pieces to this. This is where my knowledge then begins to sort of peter out. But the claim is from the paper that they are able to separate protons from positrons to 1 part in 10 to the 5. And at least for the energies of relevance here, this is well good enough so as to make sort of definitive statements about what they're seeing, and that they're actually seeing positrons. Okay. I said at the very beginning that it's something that I've been thinking about for a while. I can't resist sort of showing this. This is one of these things I get to do for this talk and not on Friday or Saturday. A long time ago, I was thinking about KK dark matter in the context of fitting what was then the heat excess. This is some sort of binned representation of the data that you saw before. It was a combination of heat and AMS. And in 2004, Dan Hooper and I had been looking at this possibility of whether KK dark matter could go and fit this. And our best fit sort of curve to this was one of these lines. The difference between the dotted line and the dashed line had to do whether it was a 300 or a 600 GeV KK particle, where, again, the annihilation rate in the galaxy was freely adjusted so as to sort of make the fit work out well. Okay? I'll be very clear about what that means in a moment. In any case, you take this from this era, and I, you know, so when I saw the data, one of the first things I did was take this thing up and plot it on top. And if I do that, this is my newfound, let's see, if I do that, there we go. So you sort of fade into the actual, you fade into the data, and if you can sort of see it faintly, here's this line that we had, and it sort of goes through the data remarkably well. So at least this is a prediction rather than a post-diction. So it looks sort of amusing. So you might be thinking then, well, okay, so if this is all, well, you...
go ahead,
Spencer.
This discrepancy at low, below 10 GeV, so, right? But I've never, it's some solar star direction.
Yes, that's...
Can you explain it?
Let me make a few words about it, and then I'm going to defer. I can defer a fuller discussion to later. In general, when you look at, so there is the sun has its cycle of solar wind. The wind then causes charged particles to be sort of pushed away from us, if you like, and in that process, they can. That can change what the energy that you would measure, the equivalent interstellar measurement, as opposed to what you observe on Earth near the sun, and so that can affect the actual information you get from one to another. Now, I don't think this is particularly well understood. However, it is true that you can look at, for example, Pamela's own data for say the proton spectrum. And let me just draw it sort of on the board. And so they have some spectrum for protons, and it looks something like this, okay, where, say, this point out here is maybe about 5 GeV. This is the flux, and each of these is the data taken in 2006, 7, 8, when they've been sort of variation of the sun. So there is at least some sense that it's already known that there is this time variation of the fluxes, and that the characteristic scale for that is sort of in this, you know, sub-GeV range. Okay, so, if KK works so well, why am I not just writing another paper about KK? I had feedback again. Here we go. The thing is that what made KK dark matter interesting, this is sort of the first and last time I'll talk about it, was that it had no velocity suppression in the annihilation rate. And this is important because whether you get an annihilation that has a velocity suppression or not is ultimately purely a particle physics thing. Okay, so it's just a matter of, you know, what kind of particles you're dealing with and what the interactions are. So this was an example of where there was no velocity suppression. Not only that, but KK dark matter being thought to be dominantly the lightest KK particle, being dominantly the this is always very hard to say in all these words in the same boat, but is the first excitation of the hypercharged gauge boson, okay, meant that this thing coupled dominantly to hypercharge. So what that meant was then that it would annihilate through particles that would be, say, KK, you know, the first KK states, and the dominant KK states that it would be annihilating through would be those that have the largest hypercharge. And you go look up your standard model book, and sure enough, the largest hypercharge are right-handed leptons. So the idea that annihilation would dominantly go to leptons would then be very natural, sort of in this context. Now, obviously, there are other particles that have large hypercharge, and so, you know, say right-handed quarks, and so doing the cross-check between this going into leptons and this going into quarks, which could then go into other particles you could try to observe, other antimatter, like antiprotons, that would follow its own program, and there is an interesting thing to do there.
Do you know if that's consistent?
Right. It's not obviously consistent, but I haven't checked it. Yeah? Okay. I haven't checked it in the following context, where you take all of the KK particles to be approximately the same mass, as was sort of the original thought when people were doing this. Yeah, exactly. But there was a different problem, which was that to get the thermal relic abundance correct for this, you actually needed the KK particles to be sort of 600 GeV or so. At that level in mass, At least for Pamela and Pamela alone, which is the subject of the talk, you need a much increased annihilation rate so as to explain this upturn, the upturn that we originally tried to explain for heat and AMS, and now seems to match the Pamela thing very well. And it was at this increase in the annihilation rate was at the level of, you know, 200 or something. Okay, that's the number that one needed. That seems larger than one would guess. Again, I'll have maybe
that's compared to uniform density, dark matter density, that sort of
precisely. Thing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so these are a few sort of motivating comments, a few things to get going. Now, what I want to do is sort of go through this a little bit more in detail and pick this apart.
Okay.
So first, annihilating dark matter. As I'm a particle physicist, this is where I start. There's two quantities that are relevant to all of this. Okay, so one is the annihilation rate, and this is something that once you know the density of dark matter, then it's basically purely a particle physics result. Namely, it is just a matter of computing a thermally averaged cross section appropriate to the era of which one is interested. So if you're interested in calculating the abundance that comes out from the early universe, then obviously you're thermally averaging for temperatures associated with that era. And if you're interested in today, in annihilations in the galactic neighborhood, well, then this is whatever it is, velocities, whatever it is. excuse me. The other vital piece is the Hubble expansion rate. This is the component that is necessary so as we can then determine the thermal relic abundance that you would expect for a particle. Okay, so this is the well-known program that one goes through with this. The annihilation, the interaction rate is just, for a non-relativistic particle, looks something along this lines, okay? So the number density is exponentially suppressed, so it's falling very quickly as temperature is decreasing. Whereas the Hubble expansion rate, at least for say radiation domination, is falling only like a power law. And so you go crack open Kolben-Turner and you see a plot like this, and then you know this is the origin of this physics. So that initially, while particles like dark matter particles being in thermal equilibrium with the background plasma, they're falling off like this, and eventually, when the interaction rate is of order of the Hubble, they kick out, and then they end up with some sort of asymptotic abundance after they have frozen out from the thermal bath in the background. This typically happens at an M over T of around 20 for the case that I'll be talking about. It's about 21, you know, for this argument. Very good. The annihilation cross section, the thermally averaged annihilation cross section, you can write in a velocity expansion like this. So some velocity independent piece plus v squared, v to the fourth, etc. These are sometimes given names, sort of S wave, P wave. Depending on which, it is purely up to the particle physics to determine what are the size of these coefficients and whether any of them are present or they vanish. There are two interesting cases. One for the sort of the dark matter. One is historical, that is that of a Majorana fermion. Majorana fermion, since it does not have vector interactions, you cannot write down any sigma naught equivalent cross section, at least in the limit that I'm taking fermion masses to be negligible. And so that it actually ends up being velocity suppressed. Okay, so it goes like some, for this type of interaction for a Majorana fermion, it goes like n squared v squared over lambda to the fourth, where I'm just writing this effective interaction like 1 over lambda squared. So this is just an effective theory, you know, with a cutoff scale lambda, and I'm just writing down the 4 fermion operator associated with this. For a Dirac fermion, on the other hand, there is no velocity suppression. And it is this that made it interesting and interestingly analogous to what happens in the KK dark matter case enough that, well, we thought we would pursue it and see how far you can go. If you take the Dirac case and you match the thermally averaged cross section with the relic abundance that cosmologists have told us we have, namely that omega h squared is of order 0.1, or it's now, what is it, 0.113, plus or minus some tiny error on the end, yeah. To extract out this abundance, roughly speaking, this abundance scales like 1 upon this interacting cross-section, this thermally average cross-section, in units of 1 picobar. So, essentially, you can then say, well, what sets of parameters, namely what mass of dark matter particle and what coupling strength of this 4-fermion interaction, would lead to that, and not surprisingly, it's exactly what you would guess. It's sort of, you know, of order a TeV scale or so for a few hundred GeV particle will give you the right relic abundance. Okay, this is just to give you an idea of the scale of this. The difference between these two lines boils down to whether in these 4-fermion operators, whether I allow for example, just electrons or all leptons or whatever else. The presence of a curious upturn in the positron ratio with the absence of any obvious deviation in the antiproton spectrum strongly suggests that these things are not quarks. There's even a stronger reason for them not to be quarks, which I'll come back to. In any case, sorry, forgive me my one little animation here, okay? In the absence of any other effects, and by that I, now that you now you know all about Sommerfeld from NEMA, so in the absence of effects such as Sommerfeld, this is it. 1 picobar is what you have to work with in terms of trying to see whether you can get an explanation of this excess that is observed by Pamela. So that's the particle physics side. On the astrophysics side, there are a number of issues. So one is first, well, how much dark matter is there in the galaxy? Well, this depends on where you are. Obviously, if you're in the center of the galaxy, it is thought that there is much higher density of dark matter. This depends on modeling of dark matter from early on, and then, you know, doing these large-scale numerical simulations to determine a typical dark matter profile, a dark matter density profile. One form is isothermal here, but there are others such as Navarro-Frank-White and others that people are aware of. The upshot is that you have some density which you can normalize to a local density. The local density itself, having some non-trivial degree of uncertainty as well, maybe at the level of a factor of 2 or so, or maybe larger, this number coming ultimately from, you know, observations of galactic motion. So typically, well, typical depends on who you talk to, but typically people are taking numbers at the level of, you know, 0.3 GeV per centimeter cubed, so one dark matter particle, roughly speaking, per liter. Okay, that's the, at least the electron scale guy. You know, that's the level we're talking about. Excuse me. Now, how much is near us? This is itself also subject to some great uncertainty. And this goes then to an issue which you've heard about, I'm sure, a little bit, and you'll hear me say it again, and I think I've already said it when talking to Spencer or others. This issue of, well, even if the uniform density of dark matter is known just from the galactic motion of objects out at, you know, 8.5 kiloparsecs where we happen to live, it is possible that we happen to live in a local overdensity, or for that matter, underdensity. Okay, and how would we know? Well, we wouldn't unless we sort of, you know, track the motions of stars for a long period of time. Okay, at the level of trying to observe these things. There is some n-body simulation support for the idea of overdensities, though the extent of the overdensity, in other words, the amount of the overdensity and the number of overdensities that one has, I think is subject to some great debate, which I am not an expert on, other than to say as I can point you to places where people discuss this, both for and against the existence of overdensities. What it means in principle, though, of course, is just something like I've sort of shown here. Okay, so this idea that as you go along in position, instead of there being an average, this is sort of an extreme example, but it's just sort of nothing with a lot and back again. And so obviously, if we happen to live in this region, then we would actually see an effective annihilation rate that would be larger. And so this corresponds to then the potential to see the products of annihilation of dark matter has the potential to see that more than what you would have ordinarily guessed from just the pure particle physics annihilation rate, simply because the density that you're taking is larger. Okay, and that's it. So this is usually given the name of a boost factor. Great. Okay, so.
How big people who think the boost factors are big in the astrophysical thing, how big do they talk about? 10? Could be a factor of 10?
Yeah, I've tried to quantify this by saying that what would be wonderful is if astrophysicists would come up with a probability function that's like the probability of a given size e to the minus then some number. That's the boost factor, and you can compute this. My opinion has always been that this number is e to the minus some number of order a few. Okay, and you put in your boost factor there, and that roughly tells you your probability. The statement is that there are some who claim that boost factors no larger than a few, 2, 3, something of that order is what is observed. And there are others who have claimed that it could be as large as tens. Okay. Beyond that, I'm not sure if anyone is seriously contemplating things. Okay.
When we talk about omega dark matter,
yes,
really integrating over the whole universe, right?
Yes,
these gigantic voids, bubbles, right, where there's nothing, including dark matter, right?
So there's
is that included in these sigma v type?
So there's several things. There is omega dark matter, which is the the amount of dark matter, if you like, if you want to be precise, it's the amount of dark matter that was present 200,000 years or so after the Big Bang, when the CMB peaks, when the acoustic oscillations burned in the amount of matter that was there. Okay, so that tells you the total amount of matter. Then through various pieces of information, nucleosynthesis and others, we know the amount that is baryonic matter. Subtracting this out, you get dark matter. Okay, so that's the dark matter that we know, or that we think we know from that era. Then as we march forward, this uniform distribution had overdensities from the usual Preschecker formalism, and then these overdensities collapsed. That causing the effective density within a galaxy to be much higher than, say, the average that you would have.
Yeah, even here in our solar system in the suburbs of the galaxy, it's still an order of magnitude or more larger than the intergalactic cluster voids, right?
Yeah.
And that's taken into account in these estimates?
Estimates of what exactly? I'm sorry.
Well, the rate
that
we might see on Earth.
That 0.3 assumes what?
I'm sorry. So the 0.3 is the estimate of the density locally. Yeah, not out there.
And if it weren't for that, we wouldn't have a chance of seeing that.
Precisely.
They froze out because they can't find each other.
Exactly.
They're so diluted. But now, once the galaxies have reconcentrated them, they can start finding each other again, and that's why we can see them annihilate.
So that
0.3
comes from
rotation curves,
et cetera, et cetera.
And peculiar velocities of stars, and it's
part of my
education. Okay, all right, very good. Annihilation to antimatter. So there are these two big pieces to it. The in some sense, the particle physics side is, at least for my purposes, easier because all it involves is an annihilation rate, which is a very simple cross section, and whatever annihilation channels happen to be open. And that boils down to saying what four fermion operators are present in the theory. The astrophysics side is much more subtle, okay, and there are many things to this. We've already talked about the subtleties associated with abundance, sort of the issues of the average density, local clumpiness, or boost factors, as they're called. But there are any number of other issues here, one of which I don't even have on the slide, which is not only are there astrophysical issues with the potential for the results of dark matter annihilation, so the matter on antimatter and how it would ultimately find us, but there's the issue of just simply, well, how much of it is not even dark matter? How much of it is just some sort of astrophysical background? Okay, and that is a big question of which is an ongoing enterprise. There are sort of two schools of thought of which it could be one, it could be the other, well, it's probably some combination of both, which is to say that there is some source of... So where can antimatter come from? You can go back to the early universe and calculate the abundance and find out it's absolutely tiny, okay, because of the baryon asymmetry. Right? That's easy enough to convince yourself of. So certainly from that level of abundance, nothing. There is antimatter created, nevertheless, though, all the time through secondary production. So energetic protons come along and hit other protons, or they hit other things. I'll talk a little bit about this. That will generate for you antimatter. That is one source of it. That definitely is there. That's how the positron was discovered, after all. Okay. So this is one source. There could be other sources, and this goes under the name of, well, these are typically some specific astrophysical object that is spewing out antimatter. Okay. Usually it's matter and antimatter. Okay. So pulsars and supernovae and such things. What I'm going to concentrate on in this thing is to assume the only background I'm going to consider is that which comes from secondary production. So that's my assumption. It could be wrong. It could be that there are point sources, and that's the sort. That's actually the true... That has a big impact on the true cosmic ray fluxes we observe, but that's not my expertise. So I'm going to only concentrate on secondary production and then consider what dark matter would be on top of. That was, by the way, how we generated this plot in 2004. We had some secondary production, and then we included dark matter on top of it.
So the reason we used the phrase antimatter is because of just the general matter antimatter violations that would contribute to that flux.
You used antimatter. Sorry. you mean
antimatter production.
Antimatter production is what is important because we observe an excess in that. Okay, for Pamela, and since that's my lot in life is to concentrate on this one result and to see what it implies. That's what I'm going to focus on. Okay, so some of the uncertainties in the astrophysics. Well, one of them is propagation. And what does this mean? Well, when you produce a particle, a charged particle, somewhere in the galaxy, and it's moving, these things are highly relativistic, so it's moving quickly. Unlike photons, where you can go and just, you know, observe them directly with appropriate detectors, charged particles are going to move around in magnetic fields, and they can much more easily scatter both off, you know, light as well as other particles. And in this process, you find that matter and antimatter can have its origins obscured, essentially because the source of the antimatter, or the source of the particles that you start with, can move around in what amounts to essentially like a random walk. Okay, so you end up with a process where to compute the flux of particles that you would observe here on Earth, you need to take into account some source of particles that you would have, and then their movement from wherever they were created, whether it be a supernova or a pulsar or just through secondary production, and then to propagate them to where we are now. So this involves both solving sort of a diffusion equation, okay, with some appropriate astrophysical parameters that have to go into this. This means a diffusion coefficient, which may be spatially dependent or otherwise. And the actual diffusion will be sensitive to the magnetic fields that are within the galaxy itself. In particular, light charged particles like electrons and positrons can move around in magnetic, they can move around much more easily, and so their direction can be randomized on much shorter distance scales. So there's sort of two pieces to this. So one is just the direction of particles can be randomized very easily. And then the second thing is that charged particles, as they hit other particles, in particular starlight and CMB, they can downscatter. Okay, and so this inverse Compton scattering, as well as the movement through magnetic fields leading to synchrotron radiation, will cause them to lose energy at the same time. So if you imagine a source just sort of sitting out there some distance away from us, you could imagine that you have matter, you have two dark matter particles, they annihilate, they create, say, an E plus E minus, and there they are with an energy that is the mass of the dark matter you start with. But then, and so there, here's our delta function in terms of a source distribution. Then, as the particles move, they will bump into light, and some of them, if you integrate over enough of them, will then eventually lead to some tail associated with the energy distribution. Now, exactly what this looks like will then obviously depend on what the source is to start with, and then how it gets propagated. And in fact, some amount of the different models of dark matter boil down to varying what kind of source you get, and then of course you'll get some equivalent propagated spectrum. The way we did this, this is something that you can do, and you can do analytically, though the extent. Well, yeah, which you can do analytically, or at least semi-analytically, though we elected not to proceed this way, and we instead used a program called Galprop. This is a piece of code that was written some time ago by Moskalenko and Strong. Their purpose was sort of somewhat different from, say, my purpose or the dark matter community. They were really interested in trying to get a map of the photon spectrum throughout the galaxy. And by that, what that means is they want to be able to get the photon spectrum, no matter where they look in the galaxy. Okay, so what they were really after. Because in part one of these guys is actually on Fermi glass, so they're interested in photons. Yeah, what they're really after is to model the entire galaxy. So no matter where you are in the galaxy, they can go out and measure the flux of all different types of cosmic rays. So photons and electrons and positrons, protons, etc. They have it's a code that incorporates the gas densities as have been measured by astronomers, incorporates magnetic fields as has been measured by astronomers in various ways. And it sort of involves a number of self-consistency checks to try to pin down, say, the propagation and diffusion so as to make the particle species that they get out self-consistent. So the fluxes they actually observe and are then sort of matched up again to the program. In some ways, you can sort of think of this as sort of an elaborate Pythia, okay? So for particle physicists, Pythia is the program that has, parton showering and hadronization, and a lot of this is fit to data so as to try to match what you actually go and observe. Well, in some ways, this program functions in a way analogous to that. There are two key things, though, that are relevant for us, or for at least this discussion. I'm just looking at the time. Two key things relevant to this discussion. One is the proton spectrum, and the other one is the electron spectrum. Okay? The reason is that secondary production, so the production of antimatter as a result of matter hitting matter, creating other particles that then decay down to antimatter, is dominated by protons. So, you need to, if you like, know the proton spectrum, or if you know the proton spectrum and you know some suitable density of gas, hydrogen, protons, then you know the positron and antiproton spectrum. So this is sort of the interesting way of proceeding, is that you can start with protons, you can use this code, and it allows you to generate a spectrum from secondary sources of antimatter. Here's, by the way, what the what the spectra that has been observed by, again, a number of experiments, some of which you'll see are familiar, the spectra of hydrogen, helium, and many heavier elements going all the way up. Now, many of these, it's not falling off as quickly as you see. Many of these are multiplied by some number just so that they can plot this on the same plot and not have overlapping data points, okay? But this gives you at least some idea of how what the spectra look like. What's interesting, of course, is the universality of all of these spectra over a wide range in energy, okay, going up to you know 10^5, 10^6 GeV. The input that goes into this program includes this spectrum as you see here. It's not exactly this spectrum because what they have to do is they have to have some injected spectrum, they propagate it, and they get some result out, and they take that result to then match up directly with this, with these results. Ratios of things like boron's not on here, but ratios of things like boron to carbon and other things can give you information about the diffusion coefficient, so they can also self-consistently determine that. Now, another piece of this is the electron or positron flux. Characterizing this as a charge or as a sign-independent quantity, so electron flux, if you like, this is, as was known pre-ATTIC 2008, okay, and what's been observed is some sort of, you know, rise up like this. This is, by the way, energy cubed times the flux, okay, and then a large scatter which has a range of about a factor of 4 or 5, or even larger, depending on how you look at it, and then sort of extending out to about a TeV. clearly, this is far better measured than that. Okay? Now, interestingly, while the program Galprop uses this, some of the spectra of protons to determine its input, and then as a consequence to determine the secondary production, the protons as measured by Panella have been presented. This is again from the Slack Summer Institute, and this is what they see, and they go. This goes up to about a few hundred GeV or so. They end up finding a spectrum which, if you take this and you suitably convolve it, because they multiply it by e to the 2.75, that's why it looks like it goes up in asymptotes. And you put this on top of the previous plot, it matches, you know, extremely well. Okay. So their protons match what other people have found extremely well. What you would then would like to be able to do then. To uncover the background is then to have, so you start with protons. This gives you the positrons and antimatter, and then you want the electron, the background electrons.
Wait a minute. Why does it give you the positrons and the antimatter?
Sorry, what?
That statement there, you said.
Yeah. So start with the protons, and through their collisions. That will give you secondary production, which will yield for you the flux of positrons and antiprotons, or antimatter, more generally, under the assumption that antimatter is all from secondary production. Okay, so once you...
Let me understand the steps. So you observe a proton flux.
Yes.
But this program requires that you then go back and figure out what the input proton flux was.
That's right.
That gave you that output.
That's right, the observed. Yep.
Then you use that input into this, whatever it's called, Galprop.
Yeah.
And out comes your predicted antimatter.
Precisely. Precisely. Yeah, so this gives you a predicted antimatter flux from secondary production. This is the data from Pamela on the actual absolute flux of electrons and positrons. Yeah? They don't have it. They haven't presented this yet. Which then leads to, by the way, an important conclusion, which is that in principle, since the positron ratio sees an excess, it is not obvious whether this is really, truly an excess in positrons or simply a deficit in electrons.
And we know nothing about whether the overall normalization is right.
And we also don't know about the normalization being correct, yeah. But the normalization is a very tricky thing to measure because that requires you to know, requires them to know the acceptance of their detector extremely well. Okay, and so that therein is a different issue.
But the proton flux that back in also requires understanding acceptances and so forth.
True, but because protons are so much more numerous than electrons and positrons, that statistics they have is, you know, 10 to the 2, 10 to the 3 times that. So what we did to uncover the background out of all of this was to use existing electron data, real flux data, to determine the shape of the electron flux. And then what we did is we took the positrons that you get out from secondary production, which are derived from protons, and then used, you know, Pamela data at some low energy point to normalize this. So what is the electron flux? Well, if you go back to this plot, this was the electron data. If you actually go through this experiment by experiment, and for us, we were actually only interested in the ranges of sort of direct relevance to Pamela, which is between about, you know, well, 5 GeV up to about 100, 5 being about the lower cutoff for this business of solar modulation, and 100 being highest energy that they observed. We found that the existing experiments had a fair spread in what the predicted, what the observed electron flux is, and it varies from e to the minus 3.5 to e to the minus 2.8 or so. Okay, plotted on here, this is what these slopes look like. I hope I did these right. Okay, so you can see that you stare at this data and you take one of these lines and you visually stick it on top and you try to normalize it properly over the energy range of sort of relevance. And you decide how well one of those would fit or not. You can see at least that the range that we have here certainly takes into account the full possible spread that you could imagine exists in the data. With that, then you can go and predict what should be the ratio that Pamela should have observed. So what you're used to seeing is a line more along the lines of one of these, you know, this e to the minus 3.15 or so. Because that's assuming the electron flux is falling at a certain rate. Now, if it actually falls faster or steeper than that, then you actually would predict the background to be more like this funny curve. Okay, and if it falls not quite as fast as that, then it would look something like this. But the key to this is that there is actually a non-trivial range in what you would get out. Now, obviously, this range will collapse once Pamela presents the actual absolute flux measurements, right? I mean, then you will know. Now, if they present flux measurements and they are qualitatively outside of this range, it's also going to tell you something very amusing about what they found.
Have they said anything at all about the electron?
I emailed them, and they said they are working on it.
It's obviously a big deal.
So. Yeah, I agree.
Can you explain why this ratio should depend upon this power loss?
Yeah, so what's going on here is, again, the positrons are flux. In absolute flux and spectrum is determined from protons. Right, so protons lead to positrons. Electrons we take from data directly. But electrons have this large variation in terms of what's been observed from other experiments. That large variation is this range.
I see. So one guy, the positron, is data-driven, is what you're saying. Yeah. Okay.
Yes, precisely. Now, the interesting thing is, I said, could it be that that the Pamela ratio could be explained by a deficit in electrons? A deficit obviously means a power that is considerably high. Well, it would have to be a deficit that is higher than even e to the minus 3.5, which is a slope that's certainly much steeper than what any other experiment has found. So presumably, that's not what they found, though it's up to them to tell us, right, to figure this out. So even with that, it's still, you know, you can't easily explain this with electron deficit. But in terms of how much dark matter you need to annihilate, well, then that depends vitally on exactly what is the flux that they observe. So this is an uncertainty that feeds into this. This is, by the way, at least at present, given the absence of information of absolute fluxes, this is actually a much larger uncertainty than some of the issues related to propagation, which is what some people have been presenting. Yeah. All right, so now I went on about dark matter. Let me at least give you what would happen with dark matter. This is a plot of a 100 GeV Dirac particle, stable Dirac particle, annihilating only to leptons, okay, and what you would predict for its positron ratio as a function of energy. The key thing to this is that exactly what you predict vitally depends on whether you're taking one of these e to the minus 2.8, e to the minus 3.15, or e to the minus 3.5 spectra. So exactly what the background electron spectra is will then depend on you know, what you would expect to get out. This had so-called boost, no boost factor, or P is 1. In other words, yes, you can actually explain the Pamela excess with no boost factor with a 100 GeV particle, okay? And but it would require that then the actual electron spectrum would be falling rather fast. Okay, that would this would be the result. Now, if it were something like this, well, then actually you would need to explain this result. You need to boost it. In other words, this there has to be an overdensity. There has to be something. How big is this boost? It's about 5. So, which is not inconsistent with at least what n-body people seem to be saying to us. If this is right, there would be a drop, right? So
you chose 100 for illustration, or that
yes, for illustration. Yes.
You have to try making the top curve fit by adjusting n.
We have not tried to fit this because the problem is that to try to fit the data would correspond to saying something about that I actually understand the electron background spectrum, which I don't, because I've just taken
it. You have a 2-parameter thing, right?
Yeah. We have not fit it.
Presumably
nor do we think that that's that interesting. But anyway, yes.
Okay. If you increase the mass, you will
not. Oh, just wait. Oh, just wait. Oh, just wait. Just wait. Okay. Varying masses.
Okay.
This is what you wanted.
That's what I wanted.
100, 204. Just this was again for illustration. This was the boost factor of 5 that I said before. What we did here is we took the background spectra to be this e to the minus 3.15, okay, which is the central value of this of the electron flux that we observed. And then this is sort of this is the type of curve you see. Then this is the sort of the corresponding boost factor. This seems unlikely, right? At least by any sort of measure. This I don't know what to make of. This doesn't seem unlikely, so that's my interpretation of it. I could talk about other different annihilation channels, but in light of time, let me just say one other thing about just as there would be a sharp drop that would be expected to be observed, at least for Pamela, can go beyond 200. It can't go beyond 400. So exactly what they could observe or not is open to question here. But just as they could observe a drop in the positron fraction to try to verify that dark matter is actually there of some mass, a corroborating experiment, namely Fermi-Glass, can look for a feature in photons. This is a very well-defined feature which is model-independent, and it simply comes from having final-state radiation being emitted from a process like this. These guys, Birkadel, Konstantin Matchev, Maxim Perlstein, and Andrew Spray, looked at the kind of feature you would get. They did this for a particular model, which I don't know if it's listed on here, but anyway, they did this for sort of a almost like a KK, like, actually, forgive me, I don't remember which model they did this for. But they did this for a particular model, which was a 100 GeV particle. And then they looked at the extent to which there would be a feature observed in the photon spectrum. And you know, sure enough, they see a sharp drop.
What is the red there?
The red is supposed to be a background, as I understand it. Yeah. So the point is that there's if there really is a drop that's observed in Pamela, you should see the same thing in Fermi-Glass. And one of the differences is in this case, you would actually more likely want to look toward the galactic center where the density of dark matter is much higher. You don't look there for antimatter because those particles have lost all their energy by the time they get to us. But when they annihilate and they produce photons, those photons will, of course, free stream all the way to us. And so this is something, this is the way you would proceed. And one of the big uncertainties is the effective relative density in the galactic center, which is this funny parameter J-bar. All right, I had some other comments about models and such things, but I think in light of time, maybe I will skip that. Other than maybe to say that. Oh, all right. Let me make 2 comments, and this is more for the.
You're not going to say anything about Attic. It doesn't look like you're.
I have comments on it, but in light of time, I think I'm not going to do them.
And what if we make a mistake?
Yes or no? Yes or no? It doesn't look very promising for ADIC, your model. Do you agree with that?
The extent to which you can explain ADIC depends vitally on what the electron spectrum falls off as.
Yeah, but I was just thinking you needed large boost factors even to get the low energy part of Pamela in your model, or even like a 300 GeV guy.
So
what made me say that? Just looking at that plot,
yeah.
It would look like you need huge boost factors.
A 400 GeV particle could have a boost factor as small as 16 and still have a feature in ADIC which looks like, since you're pressing me on this, looks something like that funny plot. Sorry, I was going crazy with the fading here. What it boils down to is then taking one of these spectra. This depends then on exactly what the background is, which depends on how quickly the electron spectrum is falling off, and then whether this is readjusted to try to match the data. By the way, this is pre-ADIC 2008, and this was in the earlier data, but I'm showing this only for your purpose. Yeah. Okay. So it certainly naively looks like you need a relatively large boost factor to fit this, but this is going to require information on the electron spectrum first to say that.
Could even be worse.
It could be
find some power law that's not as strong.
Yes, it could be. It could be. That's correct. It could be worse. It could be even worse than this. Yeah. Or it could be this. I mean, well, okay. It's up to them. I went on about this idea of a Dirac particle. You can actually realize this as a Dirac Beano. What makes this interesting is that just like a KK excitation of the hypercharged gauge boson, a Dirac Beano naturally has these operators here realized through the exchange of fermions. Okay, and all you have to, and for this, then sort of the same sort of arguments that made KK work well also make this work well, except that you don't have the same mass restrictions on the dark matter particle mass so as to get the relic abundance correct. Okay, so it makes for a much better and more interesting story. For example, so now you can have the exchange of a slepton, and if you're asking what mass that is, you just take the previous plot in terms of the four fermion operators and just realize that as an actual slepton exchange, and you find that the range is, sort of 2 to 400 GeV. Okay, so if this UV realization of these operators is right, this is what they gotta find at LHC.
So I thought from my not very careful reading of these papers on Pamela phenomenology that you have to also be careful that your whatever your dark matter is, if you're trying to explain it that way, doesn't make too many hadrons.
Yes.
So
yes.
My question is if the coupling, the rate ratios are proportional to hypercharge, are you okay with that?
Yeah. There's a separate issue. So that is an issue, but there's even a worse issue, which is that the exchange of a fermion of a first-generation type can lead to a direct detection cross-section that is too large. And you can just go and estimate how big this has to be. It turns out that you need at least the first-generation squarks, the right-handed squarks, to be larger than about 1.5
TeV.
That
I can at least do. I mean, I can't.
That's right.
The hypercharger, so.
Oh, yeah, no, but once you do this, then that's completely tiny.
Because you're going to dominate by this. You're not going to be actually dominated. I was thinking of the case where your annihilation is dominated through some hypercharge coupling.
So
you were mentioning that at the beginning.
It is, but unlike the KK case where you typically take all of the particles to have one mass scale, here you just spread out the exchange particles in some hierarchy, and you're fine.
Because
it goes
channel.
So
it's always this kind of two-channel thing, and so you can always
right.
get rid of it.
You can always get rid of it, so you have no problems whatsoever. Yeah. Which is actually a very important point, right? So it means that it is not necessary that you have a light particle just to get leptons out. Yeah. In fact, why don't I just say this? Because it's moving and it's not letting me. Yeah. There we go. Okay, let me conclude. So, Pamela itself can be explained with Dirac dark matter and a minimal boost factor, And in particular, what I showed explicitly was this case. Now, if the spectra that they observe is not this, you go and readjust this number, you readjust the boost factor, and you're done. That if this, but for this explanation to work, there has to be a drop-off, and this has certainly nothing to do with attic bets excess. The reason it works is there's no velocity suppression. Annihilation to leptons is natural given the hypercharge, but also if you take some relatively modest, you know, fermion splitting. Okay, and if you want electrons to dominate in particular, you need a splitting even among the sleptons, as well as putting the sporks, you know, somewhat heavier. This issue of if the mass is light enough, you're going to see this feature, and you'll see the feature in both of these contexts. If it's heavier, then it becomes much more harder. But then to these sort of points in comparison to sort of how other people have thought about this, I think it's important to emphasize that at least at present, given our current knowledge, you do not need Sommerfeld enhancement to explain Pamela. You do need certain well-defined quantities associated with the theory. I've talked about Dirac, I talked about the operators, I talked about how this annihilation works. But also, you don't need annihilation into a light scalar or a gauge boson. I mean, this is obvious just from the effective field theory. Okay. So this is a different way of thinking about it.
But the Sommerfeld enhancement is there, right? Would you say for your or
no?
Invariant light.
I'm sorry.
Invariant light.
Yeah, you need. Yeah. There's no Sommerfeld enhancement here. There's no new light gauge bosons that are being exchanged.
Oh.
Right,
yeah.
which is what,
yeah,
exactly, exactly, yeah. However, now to get if this excess is persists, and whether it does or not, I mean we can go back to the plot and stare at it, but I think at least one thing should give you pause. One thing should be promising, which is that both one experiment and the other both seem to see a little excess. Although the thing that gives you pause is there was some other emulsion chamber experiment which didn't see this thing. So what am I to make of that? Well, probably, especially given sort of error bars, you know, this looks pretty good. Although again, if I just sort of qualitatively look at this, I see, oh, error bars are really good along here. They're sort of crappy along here. And so then I need to figure out exactly what I make of just this bump alone. Incidentally, it's actually hard to get just this sort of excess there without seeing an excess over here. So this is not an easy game to play to make this go. Oh crap, it's James again. I'm sorry.
So we should know next Monday, right? From E glass?
Hopefully, yes, absolutely. And
where has it?
Yep.
Say.
Fantastic, even better. But let me make the clear statement here, which is then that attic bets could be simultaneously explained with larger mass, but it does need some non-trivial boost factor, something in the neighborhood of, you know, 20 to 100 or so. And this range here is primarily due to astrophysics right now. So, you know, it's interesting then to think about, well, okay, we did all this for Dirac. You can imagine, you know, Dirac with other things and da-da-da. And what it could all mean, and that's this is something interesting that we're sort of pursuing. Yeah. Okay, thank you.